Demons, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Chapter 4. The Last Resolution. That morning, many people saw Pyotr Stepanovich. All who saw him remembered that he was in a particularly excited state. At 2 o'clock, he went to see Gaganov, who had arrived from the country only the day before, and whose house was full of visitors, hotly discussing the events of the previous day. Pyotr Stepanovich talked more than anyone, and made them listen to him. He was always considered among us as a chatterbox of a student with a screw loose, but now he talked of Yulia Mikhailovna, and in the general excitement, the theme was an enthralling one. As one who had recently been her intimate and confidential friend, he disclosed many new and unexpected details concerning her. Incidentally, and of course unguardedly, he repeated some of her own remarks about persons known to all in the town, and thereby piqued their vanity. He dropped it all in a vague and rambling way, like a man free from guile, driven by his sense of honour to the painful necessity of clearing up a perfect mountain of misunderstandings, and so simple-hearted that he hardly knew where to begin and where to leave off. He let slip in a rather unguarded way, too, that Yulia Mikhailovna knew the whole secret of Stavrogin, and that she had been at the bottom of the whole intrigue. She had taken him in, too, for he, Pyotr Stepanovich, had also been in love with this unhappy Lisa. Yet he had been so hoodwinked that he had almost taken her to Stavrogin himself in the carriage. "Yes, yes, it's all very well for you to laugh, gentlemen, but if only I'd known, if only I'd known how it would end," he concluded. To various excited inquiries about Stavrogin, he bluntly replied that in his opinion the catastrophe to the Lebyadkins was a pure coincidence, and that it was all Lebyadkin's own fault for displaying his money. He explained this particularly well. One of his listeners observed that it was no good his pretending, that he had eaten and drunk and almost slept at Yulia Mikhailovna's, yet now he was the first to blacken her character, and that this was by no means such a fine thing to do as he supposed. But Pyotr Stepanovich immediately defended himself. "I ate and drank there, not because I had no money, and it's not my fault that I was invited there. Allow me to judge for myself how far I need to be grateful for that." The general impression was in his favour. "He may be rather absurd, and of course he is a nonsensical fellow, yet still he is not responsible for Yulia Mikhailovna's foolishness. On the contrary, it appears that he tried to stop her." About 2 o'clock, the news suddenly came that Stavrogin, about whom there was so much talk, had suddenly left for Petersburg by the midday train. This interested people immensely. Many of them frowned. Pyotr Stepanovich was so much struck that I was told he turned quite pale and cried out strangely. "Why? How could they have let him go?" He hurried away from Gaganov's forthwith, yet he was seen in 2 or 3 other houses. Towards dusk he succeeded in getting in to see Yulia Mikhailovna, though he had the greatest pains to do so, as she had absolutely refused to see him. I heard of this from the lady herself only 3 weeks afterwards, just before her departure for Petersburg. She gave me no details, but observed with a shudder that he had, on that occasion, astounded her beyond all belief. I imagine that all he did was to terrify her by threatening to charge her with being an accomplice if she said anything. The necessity for this intimidation arose from his plans at the moment, of which she, of course, knew nothing, and only later, 5 days afterwards, she guessed why he had been so doubtful of her reticence and so afraid of a new outburst of indignation on her part. Between 7 and 8 o'clock, when it was dark, all the 5 members of the quintet met together at Ensign Erkel's lodgings in a little crooked house at the end of the town. The meeting had been fixed by Pyotr Stepanovich himself, but he was unpardonably late, and the members waited over an hour for him. This Ensign Erkel was that young officer who had sat the whole evening at Virginsky's with a pencil in his hand and a notebook before him. He had not long been in the town. He lodged alone with 2 old women, sisters, in a secluded by-street, and was shortly to leave the town. A meeting at his house was less likely to attract notice than anywhere. This strange boy was distinguished by extreme taciturnity. He was capable of sitting for a dozen evenings in succession in noisy company, with the most extraordinary conversation going on around him, without uttering a word, though he listened with extreme attention, watching the speakers with his childlike eyes. His face was very pretty, and even had a certain look of cleverness. He did not belong to the quintet. It was supposed that he had some special job of a purely practical character. It is known now that he had nothing of the sort, and probably did not understand his position himself. It was simply that he was filled with hero worship for Pyotr Stepanovich, whom he had only lately met. If he had met with a monster of iniquity who had incited him to found a band of brigands on the pretext of some romantic and socialistic object, and as a test had bidden him rob and murder the first peasant he met, he would certainly have obeyed and done it. He had an invalid mother, to whom he sent half of his scanty pay, and how she must have kissed that poor little flaxen head, how she must have trembled and prayed over it. I go into these details about him because I feel very sorry for him. Our fellows were excited. The events of the previous night had made a great impression on them, and I fancy they were in a panic. The simple disorderliness in which they had so zealously and systematically taken part had ended in a way they had not expected. The fire in the night, the murder of the Lebyadkins, the savage brutality of the crowd with Liza had been a series of surprises which they had not anticipated in their programme. They hotly accused the hand that had guided them of despotism and duplicity. In fact, while they were waiting for Pyotr Stepanovich, they worked each other up to such a point that they resolved again to ask him for a definite explanation, and if he evaded again, as he had done before, to dissolve the quintet and to found instead a new secret society for the propaganda of ideas, and on their own initiative on the basis of democracy and equality. Liputin, Shigalyov, and the authority on the peasantry supported this plan. Lyamshin said nothing, though he looked approving. Virginsky hesitated and wanted to hear Pyotr Stepanovich first. It was decided to hear Pyotr Stepanovich, but still he did not come. Such casualness added fuel to the flames. Erkel was absolutely silent and did nothing but order the tea, which he brought from his landlady's in glasses on a tray, not bringing in the samovar nor allowing the servant to enter. Pyotr Stepanovich did not turn up till 8:30. With rapid steps, he went up to the circular table before the sofa round which the company were seated. He kept his cap in his hand and refused tea. He looked angry, severe, and supercilious. He must have observed at once from their faces that they were mutinous. "Before I open my mouth, you've all got something hidden. Out with it." Liputin began, in the name of all, and declared in a voice quivering with resentment that if things were going on like that, they might as well blow their brains out. Oh, they were not at all afraid to blow their brains out. They were quite ready to, in fact, but only to serve the common cause, a general movement of approbation. So he must be more open with them, that they might always know beforehand. Or what else would things be coming to? Again, a stir and some guttural sounds. To behave like this was humiliating and dangerous. "We don't say so because we are afraid, but if one acts and the rest are only pawns, then one would blunder and all would be lost." Exclamations. "Yes, yes." General approval. "Damn it all, what do you want?" "What connection is there between the common cause and the petty intrigues of Mr. Stavrogin?" cried Liputin, boiling over. "Suppose he is in some mysterious relation to the centre, if that legendary centre really exists at all. It's no concern of ours. And meantime, a murder has been committed. The police have been roused. If they follow the thread, they may find what it starts from." "If Stavrogin and you are caught, we shall be caught too," added the authority on the peasantry. "And to no good purpose for the common cause," Virginsky concluded despondently. "What nonsense! The murder is a chance crime. It was committed by Fetka for the sake of robbery. Strange coincidence, though, said Liputin, wriggling. And if you will have it, it's all through you. Through us? In the first place, you, Liputin, had a share in the intrigue yourself, and the second chief point is you were ordered to get Lebyadkin away and given money to do it. And what did you do? If you'd got him away, nothing would have happened. But wasn't it you yourself who suggested the idea that it would be a good thing to set him on to read his verses? An idea is not a command. The command was to get him away. Command? Rather a queer word. On the contrary, your orders were to delay sending him off. You made a mistake and showed your foolishness and self-will. The murder was the work of Fedka, and he carried it out alone for the sake of robbery. You heard the gossip and believed it. You were scared. Stavrogin is not such a fool, and the proof of that is that he left the town at 12 o'clock after an interview with the vice-governor. If there were anything in it, they would not let him go to Petersburg in broad daylight. But we are not making out that Mr. Stavrogin committed the murder himself, Liputin rejoined spitefully and unceremoniously. He may have known nothing about it, like me, and you know very well that I knew nothing about it, though I am mixed up in it like mutton in a hash. Whom are you accusing? Said Pyotr Stepanovich, looking at him darkly. Those whose interest it is to burn down towns. You make matters worse by wriggling out of it. However, won't you read this and pass it to the others, simply as a fact of interest? He pulled out of his pocket Lebyadkin's anonymous letter to Lempke and handed it to Liputin. The latter read it, was evidently surprised, and passed it thoughtfully to his neighbour. The letter quickly went the round.
"Is that really Lebyadkin's handwriting?" observed Shigalyov. "It is," answered Liputin and Tolkachenka, the authority on the peasantry.
"I simply brought it as a fact of interest, and because I knew you were so sentimental over Lebyadkin," repeated Pyotr Stepanovich, taking the letter back. "So it turns out, gentlemen, that a stray Fedka relieves us quite by chance of a dangerous man. That's what chance does sometimes. It's instructive, isn't it?" The members exchanged rapid glances. "And now, gentlemen, it's my turn to ask questions," said Pyotr Stepanovich, assuming an air of dignity. "Let me know what business you had to set fire to the town without permission."
"What's this? We set fire to the town? That is laying the blame on others," they exclaimed.
"I quite understand that you carried the game too far," Pyotr Stepanovich persisted stubbornly. "But it's not a matter of petty scandals with Yulia Mikhailovna. I've brought you here, gentlemen, to explain to you the greatness of the danger you have so stupidly incurred, which is a menace to much beside yourselves."
"Excuse me. We, on the contrary, were intending just now to point out to you the greatness of the despotism and unfairness you have shown in taking such a serious and also strange step without consulting the members," Virginsky, who had been hitherto silent, protested, almost with indignation.
"And so you deny it. But I maintain that you set fire to the town, you and none but you. Gentlemen, don't tell lies. I have good evidence. By your rashness, you exposed the common cause to danger. You are only one knot in an endless network of knots, and your duty is blind obedience to the centre. Yet three men of you incited the Spigulin men to set fire to the town without the least instruction to do so, and the fire has taken place."
"What three? What three of us?"
"The day before yesterday, at 3 o'clock in the night, you, Tolkachenka, were inciting Fonka Zavyalov at the Forget-Me-Not."
"Upon my word," cried the latter, jumping up, "I scarcely said a word to him, and what I did say was without intention, simply because he had been flogged that morning. And I dropped it at once. I saw he was too drunk. If you had not referred to it, I should not have thought of it again. A word could not set the place on fire."
"You are like a man who should be surprised that a tiny spark could blow a whole powder magazine into the air."
"I spoke a whisper in his ear in a corner. How could you have heard of it?"
Tolkachenko reflected suddenly. "I was sitting there under the table. Don't disturb yourselves, gentlemen. I know every step you take. You smile sarcastically, Mr. Liputin, but I know, for instance, that you pinched your wife black and blue at midnight 3 days ago in your bedroom as you were going to bed." Liputin's mouth fell open, and he turned pale. It was afterwards found out that he knew of this exploit of Liputin's from Agafya, Liputin's servant, whom he had paid from the beginning to spy on him. This only came out later.
"May I state a fact?" said Shigalyov, getting up.
"State it."
Shigalyov sat down and pulled himself together. "So far as I understand, and it's impossible not to understand it, you yourself at first, and a second time later, drew with great eloquence, but too theoretically, a picture of Russia covered with an endless network of knots, each of these centres of activity proselytizing and ramifying endlessly, aims by systematic denunciation to injure the prestige of local authority, to reduce the villages to confusion, to spread cynicism and scandals, together with complete disbelief in everything and an eagerness for something better, and finally by means of fires, as a preeminently national method to reduce the country at a given moment, if need be, to desperation. Are those your words which I tried to remember accurately? Is that the program you gave us as the authorized representative of the Central Committee, which is to this day utterly unknown to us and almost like a myth? It's correct, only you are very tedious. Everyone has a right to express himself in his own way. Giving us to understand that the separate knots of the general network already covering Russia number by now several hundred, and propounding the theory that if everyone does his work successfully, all Russia at a given moment, at a signal...
"Ah, damn it all, I have enough to do without you," cried Pyotr Stepanovich, twisting in his chair.
"Very well, I'll cut it short, and I'll end simply by asking if we've seen the disorderly scenes. We've seen the discontent of the people, we've seen and taken part in the downfall of local administration, and finally we've seen with our own eyes the town on fire. What do you find amiss? Isn't that your program? What can you blame us for?"
"Acting on your own initiative," Pyotr Stepanovich cried furiously. "While I am here, you ought not to have dared to act without my permission. Enough. We are on the eve of betrayal, and perhaps tomorrow or tonight you'll be seized. So there, I have authentic information."
At this, all were agape with astonishment. "You will be arrested, not only as instigators of the fire, but as a quintet. The traitor knows the whole secret of the network, so you see what a mess you've made of it."
"Stavrogin, no doubt," cried Liputin.
"What? Why Stavrogin?"
Pyotr Stepanovich seemed suddenly taken aback.
"Hang it all," he cried, pulling himself together at once. "It's Shatov. I believe you all know now that Shatov in his time was one of the society. I must tell you that, watching him through persons he does not suspect, I found out to my amazement that he knows all about the organization of the network and everything, in fact. To save himself from being charged with having formerly belonged, he will give information against all. He has been hesitating up till now, and I have spared him. Your fire has decided him. He is shaken and will hesitate no longer. Tomorrow we shall be arrested as incendiaries and political offenders."
"Is it true? How does Shatov know?"
The excitement was indescribable.
"It's all perfectly true. I have no right to reveal the source from which I learnt it or how I discovered it, but I tell you what I can do for you meanwhile. Through one person I can act on Shatov so that without his suspecting it he will put off giving information, but not more than for 24 hours.
All were silent.
"We really must send him to the devil," Tolkachenko was the first to exclaim.
"It ought to have been done long ago," Lyamshin put in malignantly, striking the table with his fist.
"But how is it to be done?" muttered Liputin.
Pyotr Stepanovich at once took up the question and unfolded his plan. The plan was the following day at nightfall to draw Shatov away to a secluded spot to hand over the secret printing press, which had been in his keeping and was buried there, and there to settle things. He went into various essential details, which we will omit here, and explained minutely Shatov's present ambiguous attitude to the Central Society, of which the listener knows already.
"That's all very well," Liputin observed irresolutely, "but since it will be another adventure of the same sort, it will make too great a sensation."
"No doubt," answered Pyotr Stepanovich, "but I have provided against that. We have the means of averting suspicion completely."
And with the same minuteness, he told them about Kirillov,
of his intention to shoot himself, and of his promise to wait for a signal from them and to leave a letter behind him, taking on himself anything they dictated to him, all of which the listener knows already. His determination to take his own life, a philosophic, or as I should call it, insane decision, has become known there, Pyotr Stepanovich went on to explain. There, not a thread, not a grain of dust is overlooked. Everything is turned to the service of the cause. Foreseeing how useful it might be, and satisfying themselves that his intention was quite serious, they had offered him the means to come to Russia. He was set, for some reason, on dying in Russia, gave him a commission which he promised to carry out, and he had done so, and had, moreover, bound him by a promise, as you already know, to commit suicide only when he was told to. He promised everything. You must note that he belongs to the organization on a particular footing and is anxious to be of service. More than that, I can't tell you. Tomorrow, after Shartov's affair, I'll dictate a note to him saying that he is responsible for his death. That will seem very plausible. They were friends and travelled together to America. There they quarrelled, and it will all be explained in the letter. And perhaps, if it seems feasible, we might dictate something more to Kirillov. Something about the manifestos, for instance, and even perhaps about the fire. But I'll think about that. You needn't worry yourselves. He has no prejudices. He'll sign anything. There were expressions of doubt. It sounded like a fantastic story, but they had all heard more or less about Kirillov. Liputin more than all. "He may change his mind and not want to," said Shigalyov. "He is a madman anyway, so he is not much to build upon." "Don't be uneasy, gentlemen, he will want to," Pyotr Stepanovich snapped out. "I am obliged by our agreement to give him warning the day before, so it must be today. I invite Liputin to go with me at once to see him and make certain, and he will tell you, gentlemen, when he comes back, today if need be, whether what I say is true. However—" He broke off suddenly with intense exasperation, as though he suddenly felt he was doing people like them too much honour by wasting time in persuading them. "However, do as you please. If you don't decide to do it, the Union is broken up, but solely through your insubordination and treachery. In that case, we are all independent from this moment, but under those circumstances, besides the unpleasantness of Shartov's betrayal and its consequences, you will have brought upon yourselves another little unpleasantness of which you were definitely warned when the Union was formed. As far as I am concerned, I am not much afraid of you, gentlemen. Don't imagine that I am so involved with you. But that's no matter." "Yes, we decide to do it," Liputin pronounced. "There's no other way out of it," muttered Tolkachenko. "And if only Liputin confirms about Kirillov, then—" "I am against it. With all my soul and strength, I protest against such a murderous decision," said Virginsky, standing up. "But?" asked Pyotr Stepanovich. "But what?" "You said but, and I am waiting." "I don't think I did say but. I only meant to say that if you decide to do it, then—" "Then?" Virginsky did not answer. "I think that one is at liberty to neglect danger to one's own life," said Erkel, suddenly opening his mouth. "But if it may injure the cause, then I consider one ought not to dare to neglect danger to one's life." He broke off in confusion, blushing. Absorbed as they all were in their own ideas, they all looked at him in amazement. It was such a surprise that he, too, could speak. "I am for the cause," Virginsky pronounced suddenly. Everyone got up. It was decided to communicate once more and make final arrangements at midday on the morrow, though without meeting. The place where the printing press was hidden was announced, and each was assigned his part and his duty. Liputin and Pyotr Stepanovich promptly set off together to Kirillov.